Yes.
This is sort of a new idea of stream entry.
It's not a new idea, it's the Buddha's idea.
But it's not the idea that I've been taught.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of wanting to deconstruct that notion or that teaching and then embrace more of this. So I guess what I'm saying is it's not just easy to figure out what's going on about this. So I guess what to do.
Well, in some ways, you see, I mean, this is something I've had to do. I mentioned this morning. You kind of have to unlearn stuff. The problem is when we learn these things, sometimes we do so over a period of years, and it becomes so much part of our sort of inner, sort of implicit understanding that when such ideas are challenged, it's not just a question that you just sort of delete that bit of knowledge. You just press the delete button. It's still with you. It still defines somehow how you see things. You find that learning has been internalized to some degree. That's actually quite difficult to sort of work your way out of. It's tricky. For example, people think that the Buddha was a prince who was born in a palace and went outside the palace walls and saw the four sights. This is so impregnated, even before we got to know Buddhism, we knew that. Now, when you realize that actually just wasn't true, I find it extremely difficult, even now, to not think in those terms, because it's so embedded. And the same with a lot of these ideas. So in a way, you have to start rethinking. I mean, this is the Buddha's definition of stream entry. He says, a noble disciple possesses four things is a stream entry. Four things. What for, he says. When a disciple possesses confirmed confidence in the Buddha, when a disciple possesses firm confidence in the Dhamma, and firm confidence in the Sangha, and possesses the virtues dear to the nobleman. That's in the Sotapatta Sanyutta, in the Connected Discourses on Stream Entry, which is the longest passage dedicated to that topic in the entire Pali Canon, this is how he defines it. Now, I was never taught this. I was taught that it had to do with getting rid of three fetters. I've only found one passage in the canon where he mentions this. One passage, that's in the Sutta Nipata. And I think that's also is part of it too, for sure. But it's interesting, you see, that is a psychological interpretation. Stream entry has become internalized. It's become, something has changed in your mind in some way. Which is fine. But it's left out the whole other dimension, which presents stream entry as a reorientation of your life in all aspects of it. Your primary, you've focused your life now on this idea of waking up, where the image of the Buddha or the idea of the Buddha is a sort of archetype or normative image you wish to aspire to. It has to do with your confidence in the Dhamma. And of course, the Dhamma means an awful lot of things, but broadly it speaks to your practice, your way of life, the Eightfold Path. It has to do with your confidence in the community that supports this endeavor. It has to do with also a commitment to virtue, a term we don't find very often eulogized in Buddhism. But again, all of these are very affirmative things that you do. These are positive statements. But getting rid of the three fetters are negatives. So we think of stream entry as dropping off things, which is true. But it ignores how the primary definition is a positive one. And it also brings the thing down to earth. We tend to think of stream entry as a rather high and elevated accomplishment that maybe some monks after years of practice will arrive at. And again, this is the privileging of experiences which are regarded highly within monastic-type situations. And so stream entry has come universally in Buddhism to mean the letting go of the individuality view, the letting go of attachment to rites and rituals, and no longer having any doubt. Fine. But it ignores the wider dimension, which has to do with living your life from another perspective altogether. So the experience of stopping craving, opening up the practice of the path. And again, the Buddha is very clear. The stream, Sariputta. What now, Sariputta, is the stream? This Noble Eightfold Path is the stream. That doesn't mean, you know, your spiritual, some inner spiritual attainment. Now, there's a very interesting passage here, which really brings it all down to earth, and this concerns a man called Sarakani the Sakya, who I suppose nobody's ever heard of. Now, on that occasion, the Buddha says, Sarakani the Sakya had died, and the Buddha had declared him to be a stream entrant. Thereupon, a number of Sakyans deplored this, and they came to the Buddha saying, "Oh, wonderful, wonderful indeed. Now who won't be a stream enterer when the Buddha has declared Sarakani to be a stream enterer?" Sarakani, the Sakyan, was too weak for the training. He drank intoxicating drink. He was the town drunk. Right? Now, when this was reported to the Buddha said, if one speaking rightly were to say of anyone, he was a lay follower who had gone for refuge over a long time to the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, it is of Sarakani the Sakyan that one could rightly say this. The town drunk. Now, again, it's amazing that this passage has survived. Yes.
Even before you read that, it was sounding like stream entry and taking the refuges were more or less
the same. Exactly. And the Buddha repeats this endlessly. Now, taking the refuges now has become debased into signing up to the Buddhist club.
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. It's become a ritualistic formula.
It's not about the ritual.
But the real stream entry means to actually have turned your life in another direction.
The word that comes to mind that several teachers have used is inclination. That even if one is still failing, one continually returns to inclining one's mind.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And again, I think this is again why how. I mean, this is clearly in a lay context, particularly the Sarakani one. There's another passage in the Sutta Nipata that unfortunately I haven't copied out, where the Buddha says that the person who has entered the stream, who has taken the refuges genuinely, not just as a cultural habit or joining up to a club, even if they lead the rest of their lives in heedlessness, they will still be pursuing the path. And this is in some respects resonant with the idea of being born again, in a Christian sense, in a way. Mm-hmm. It's a new birth. And it's about the fact that however many flaws and failings you might have, your life has turned around from being primarily preoccupied with getting this and getting rid of that and fulfilling your self-centered desires, to one in which you at least aspire to living in another way. And that seems to be what stream entry is. I think what has happened over time is that stream entry has been progressively elevated out of reach.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now this is actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Feuerbach's critique of religion that Marx adopted, but that's exactly what Feuerbach says. He says religion as an institution is a system of alienation. And the more that the religious authorities gain power, the more that they become powerful and somehow a privileged elite, they achieve that status by distancing the qualities that they celebrate, wisdom, love, and so on. These qualities become increasingly removed from the ordinary person. So for Marx and for Feuerbach, people come to project their human values onto these priests and monks and lamas and whatever, and in a sense divest themselves or fail to, in a sense, even recognize that though these qualities are in fact their own. And this, I think, this would be, you could do a Feuerbachian type study of Buddhism and see exactly the same process at work. That stream entry becomes an almost impossible ideal, that unless you're a monk, you don't even have a remote chance of gaining it. Whereas the Buddha seems to be saying, basically, stream entry means anyone who gets the basic idea and says, yes, that's how I'm going to live from now on. That's stream entry. Yes?
It seems like it's a really fundamental piece that is this very thorough, to use the Buddha's kind of words about a knowing of Dharma, Sangha, Buddha. I mean, not a psychological confidence. I mean, God, if I had to have psychological confidence about Sangha, human imperfections of up and down and craziness, that's a... Do you see him getting that?
Well, he's a little specific when he describes Sangha. He means people who are stream entrants and above. But again, what a stream entrance... See, that's interesting.
Yeah.
We've just downgraded stream entrants. But I think it is.
It's Walmart.
No, but it's again, partly it's similar to the notion of a church. The church doesn't mean the building at the end of the street with a cross on it. The church in Christian theology means the body of Christ. It means those who participate in the life of Christ. And I think in a similar sense, the Sangha are those who participate in the life of the Dhamma, or the life of Buddha Dhamma.
You've turned to that kind of life.
Yeah, you've turned to that life, but that doesn't mean, profoundly, seriously, basically. And again, I think often Buddhist... we don't take people seriously enough. I mean, the fact is that perhaps we don't take ourselves seriously enough. We make these decisions and choices that are deeply important for us without falling into some conceit that we've now become somehow enlightened or something. But we recognize, often after a period of crisis in our lives, a period of disorientation, of maybe great suffering, that we find this way of thinking, this way of practicing, this way of living, this set of symbols, this Buddhist culture, and we feel at home in it. And we say, yes, for all of my failings, for all of my craziness, this is what I'm going to try to build my life around. And that, I think, is what it means to take refuge, to enter the path. But again, it's not an act you commit once. It's ongoing. You're constantly being challenged to live up to that ideal, and you're constantly falling short, probably. But you've now got to the point where you can't somehow, step back and sort of walk away. You realize that these are the things that matter most to you at some level, and you need to live as truly as you can with regard to those ideas and values. And it'll be painful at times. You'll feel that you're not getting anywhere. But the problem is, if we set this stream entry and all this stuff, if we set the bar too high, we'll always feel somehow diminished. We'll always feel somehow that we're not really getting anywhere. And it's only the others, the teachers, the monks, the lamas, the whatevers. They're the ones who've got it. And we're just poor, struggling souls who are trying to sort of grope towards this ideal. But that, I think, is extraordinarily disempowering. Mm-hmm. And so part of this whole, these readings, is to actually, to empower ourselves. Even, Sarakani, the town drunk, the local doper, if he can get it, then why, that is, to me, is a very positive story. It's got a Christian ring to it. Yeah. The cynic. Very much so.
I think it strikes me too that it's easy to get confused about what Sangha is.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sangha, you're describing to me, it sounds more like noble companionship, the fellowship of people who have turned radically towards this new way of life.
That's right.
Mm. Versus the institution of Sangha, or the organization of Sangha, or the, because in the West, it's a big thing. Sangha's been institutionalized heavily.
But again, it's the same difference between the body of Christ and the church at the end of the road.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's exactly the same problem.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult... It'll be a tension, I think. I think it's unavoidable.
Right.
But But I think perhaps it also gives rise to an important question, is can we do Sangha differently? Do we have to assume that we're only succeeding as a Sangha when we can afford to buy a nice big building? That's often how it seems to go, I've noticed.
Or our 501c3 comes
out. All this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think this is perhaps somewhere where we can begin to evolve into Sanghas that are more, perhaps more, that the institutional aspect becomes more virtual, for example. I don't see why not. I do think it's extremely important that we meet together as warm bodies in a room. Mm-hmm. But do we need to be burdened by the institutional edifices that tend to grow up, and then all the hierarchies of power that inevitably become established? And then that very easily, that tipping point where there's a certain percentage of people in the Sangha who are actually more interested in preserving and developing the structures.
Yeah,
exactly. In other words, becoming professional Buddhists.
I just want to say this today feels more like Sangha to me than anything I've participated in.
Yeah.
Probably since I've become, I don't call myself a Buddhist, but since I've been practicing.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting.
Because this is, we're coming together, we're learning, we're hearing, we're discussing, we're engaging with each other. During lunch, a couple of us started to talk about the ideas. To me, or at least in my heart, that's what I want from Sangha, not a structure and an organization.
Yes, Jenny.
Well, I know along the way to where we are now as the Albuquerque Sangha, there have been a lot of complaints about, well, we're getting too much like a church and we're getting too organized. But the problem is, in today's world, if you want to have just even enough funds to function, the only way you're going to get donations is if you are a 501c3.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, otherwise, you can keep struggling along and being supported by maybe a few people who can afford to do this without taking the deduction.
That's right.
And sometimes the structures become necessary, but they don't have to take over.
Well, that is the challenge. Can we learn to live more lightly with the structures so that they cease, so they're less likely to become a burden? I don't know. I think there are other... The Quakers, I think, have got it fairly good.
Yeah.
I like the way the Quakers are organized. I like the fact they don't have priests, you see. There's an egalitarianism within the Quaker organization. But on the other hand, I often, especially in America, I often say very positive things about the Quakers. There's invariably a Quaker in the room, and they go, well, actually, we spend a lot of time in meetings. Because everything has to be consensus. Well, it's not quite consensus. They've got a slightly different word for it.
Zen peacemakers have an interesting model.
Yeah, well, that's another... Again, there are groups who are trying to rethink this and do it in another way.
Mm-hmm. But in the spirit of having a little bit of time, can we find out what happens after you become a stream entrant? And...
what happens next? Well, basically, it's more of the same. The challenge then is... The stream is the Eightfold Path. I think we've got good canonical basis for that. The Eightfold Path, the Buddha says, is to be brought into being, is to be created, is to be cultivated, which means that your practice becomes your whole life. Yeah. Now, this is the other problem, I think, of the monastic-centered, meditative-centered practice, is that if you ask a bunch of Buddhists at random, what's your practice? What will they say? They'll name some spiritual exercise. I practice Zen, I practice Vipassana, I practice Nara. That, I think, already gives the game away. Practice gets reduced to a certain kind of proficiency within a certain sort of spiritual technique. Whereas the way the Buddha seems to be understanding practice is that the way I see myself and others, the way I think, the way I speak, the way I act, the way I work. It's very striking that he includes work, you see, livelihood. Very interesting. The way I make use of resources, the way I provide for myself and my family. The very earliest ideas of this rather confusing word, Buddha nature, apparently I gave a talk on this when I was here last time, and I've just been given a copy of it myself. But one of the very, the earliest instance of a term that is, the idea that evolved into Buddha nature, this rather mystical idea, started with the idea of Aryagota, which means the noble family. And the Buddha says that a person who belongs to the noble family is one who is content with clothing, content with shelter, content with food, and delights in bhavana, the cultivation of the path. So in other words, again, three of the four have got nothing to do with spiritual practice. They've got to do with providing the material necessities of life and being content with basically a simple, adequate living. That is necessary prior to the engagement with the actual cultivation of the path. So again, it's very down to earth. It's not at all about Buddha nature as some mystical sort of spiritual essence that's somehow waiting to get out of your innermost chakra or something. It's about contentment with the world. And it implies that a Buddhist society or community would be one that would seek to ensure those basic provisions in a society or in a community, to take care of one another in terms of one's material needs. And also to create contexts in which these qualities of the Eightfold Path are then developed. But the trouble is, when you look in the canon for, say, something on right livelihood, you don't find much. You find the Sigil of Adasutta, you find some other texts. But if you look for the practice of mindfulness or jhanas, there's pages and pages and pages and pages of spiritual exercises. It's as though it's somehow got distorted. Certain aspects of the path have become privileged, probably because that's what monks and nuns were into doing. And yet we, in a way, have to figure out, to answer your question, how do I practice right livelihood? The texts say, well, you mustn't trade in slaves or poisons. I don't think somehow we're going to do that. It doesn't really, it's not very helpful, and it's not particularly relevant to the sort of world we live in today. So there's all sorts of questions that are not really addressed canonically. Right speech, right action. These things sound like nice ideas, but how do you actually make them into a practice? That's quite challenging. And there's very little guidance as to, or even a framework for how to pursue such practices. And so, you know, I can, at the same time, I don't want to diminish the importance of practicing meditation. I think it is important. It's very important. But I don't think it's particularly meaningful or can be really an enriching part of your life unless it's integrated with all those other elements. Yeah.
When you talk of, or suttas talk about things like right livelihood or even right speech, are those ethical or life practice in the real world uniquely Buddhist, or would a Jain or others who are running around at the same time have shared that orientation as to what constitutes?
I think the latter. I don't think the Buddha says anything particularly original when it comes to much of that. And if we read them today, we would say, well, that's just common sense. You know, don't lie, don't speak behind people's backs, don't shout at people, don't gossip. You know, it's not, it's not a particularly in-depth analysis of the ethics of speech.
I mean, so if the Buddha didn't develop, or as far as we know, emphasize these.
Well, I think all we can safely say is the canon has not emphasized these things. I find it hard to believe the Buddha wouldn't have done, but maybe he didn't. Maybe he was quite content with the sort of general ethic that was normative in his culture. Quite possibly. But in a way, that doesn't really matter. The challenge for us is, well, what do those things mean for us now? And how can those practices be integrated into this wider vision of this kind of culture the Buddha seems to want to create? I think we are building something here on the basis of fragments. In a way, it's fragmentary. The bits of the canon that I've picked out are fragments from here and there. I think they hang together quite coherently, but they're not very substantial as a body. The body of the canon has been developed largely in the direction of transcendence and renunciation and so forth and so on. And so in a sense we have relatively few resources, which is both a limitation but also an opportunity. I mean, can we work these things out? And I think a lot of stuff that is going on in the West and also in modern Asia is more and more Buddhists are trying to, for example, understand what it means to be socially engaged. Huge interest in this. And in different areas too, of the arts to some degree. I think the arts is an area that's completely undervalued as well. Artistic expression, aesthetic experience. But that's something that, you know, that we are, in a way, kind of on our own with, I'm afraid. And we don't get a great deal of help. We get a lot of help in terms of how to practice mindfulness, which is useful, definitely, because it's something that in our culture is lacking. That's one of the attractions of Buddhism, yes.
I want to just regress for a bit, because you threw a question out there, and what the question was, how can we find happiness and joy by fully understanding
suffering? Yeah.
Suffering. And I was thinking about that for quite a bit, but when you look at it from a general thing, one of the things that we're most afraid of are things that we don't understand.
That's right, yeah.
So if we get to the point of understanding these things, I should think that a lot of the fear about them goes away.
I think that's right.
That's why I don't know what it is about the Tibetans, but they always look so happy. And they don't really have that many causes. I mean, considered in the way most people look at things, you think, oh, these poor people, they should be very sad. And in point of fact, they're not.
Yes and no. If you live with any people for any length of time, you'll realize that very few people are permanently happy.
Of course.
But no, I think their culture has given them a great richness that they draw upon. Yes?
The Eightfold Path, was it laid out intentionally, you know, 1 through 8?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's to me, it's very clearly structured, moving from inner to outer, basically. It has I've noticed that all of it, that there's a kind of rhythm, a kind of a pattern that works through. You start with something most interior, which is the way you see things. Then it's about thinking. Then it's about speaking. At each step, you move that much more into life, acting, working. And that's, in a sense, is about as far as that ethical, socialized aspect goes. And then on that basis, which I think is a very important point, that your practice of meditation needs to be grounded in an ethical life. And the ethical life somehow needs to be informed by an inner reflective understanding and view. So I see them very much as... I see it as a process that has, I think, a quite definite progression to it. But it doesn't end at concentration. That's the point, not to get confused about that, but to realize that the mindfulness and the concentration take you back.
It's recursive.
Yeah, that's a good word. It's recursive. Exactly.
Looks like we've been doing on our community nights when we run the meetings ourselves, we've been going through the paramis.
Mm-hmm.
And they build one on the other.
That's right.
I mean, you couldn't get to equanimity without having gone through all that other stuff. Equanimity just doesn't pop out of the air.
That's number 10, is it?
Yeah.
I'm not so familiar with the paramis. Strangely, the paramis don't hardly occur in the canon.
Aren't they more of a Mahayana teaching, the paramis?
Well, the six perfections are Mahayana. Mm-hmm. Giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, wisdom. That's the classic Mahayana six perfections, which are very similar. But I think the paramis came along somewhat later in the day, another sort of way of codifying the virtues of Buddhism. I think they're fine. I have no problem.
They came after the Mahayana six perfections.
I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that question. The chances are they emerge probably either simultaneously. If anything, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think we can possibly know that. I don't know.
I have one
yes.
kind of technical
quickly
question.
Yes, technical question.
Okay. Is... the canon digitized so that you can search through it?
Yeah.
Oh.
In Pali.
So you have to understand Pali.
Well, afraid so. You must, one of the great things, actually, that Pali canon is all in, it's been Romanized. So it's all in Roman letters. You don't have to learn squiggle.
Ah.
And that was done. There is no Pali script. There never has been. Wherever Pali, whichever country Pali went into, it was transcribed in the alphabet of that country. So when it came into the West, it was immediately transcribed into A, B, C, D, E, F, Roman, with bars and dots and diacritics. And that's all now online. So if you want to find a passage in a text, all you have to do is bing, and then you've got it in Pali. But then you can check the Pali, and you can check it with English translations. There's not yet a translation of the Pali canon in which has uniform terminology. This is part of the problem. Different translators, or even the same translators, will keep changing their minds. So that makes it difficult to envisage, in the short term, an English version of the Pali canon online with uniform terminology. And if we don't have uniform terminology, it's very difficult to track what the Buddha said about a particular term or phrase if different translators are doing it differently. But we're getting there. I mean, we should be enormously grateful to the people who've been doing this work for the last 130 years now. If you were living in France or Germany or Italy or Spain or Portugal, you'd have access to virtually zilch. We have access to at least two or three versions of the whole thing. We're incredibly lucky. I don't think this is sufficiently well appreciated. And work of people like Bhikkhu Bodhi and Tan Jeff, I think, is just fantastic. It really is making these materials available, even though they might be interpreted and read and selected in ways that the translators would prefer they weren't. Karen, did you have...
On some talks of yours that I listened to, I was really taken by your discussion of creativity within the path. And I think you've basically kind of been talking about that. But I'd just be interested to hear more about kind of the role of creativity in creating our path and our practice.
Well, I think it's, to me, it's interesting that at least in Pali and Sanskrit traditions, there is no word that corresponds to the English word creativity. We don't have the Buddha talking about, bhikkhus, I will teach you about creativity. You don't find that. But on the other hand, this word bhavana, you see, suggests creativity. The path is to be brought into being, to be created. And this, to me, suggests that at least Sama Sankapa, what is usually translated as right thought, perhaps could also include right imagination. See, the imagination to me is somewhere intermediary between our primary vision and how we translate that vision into form. You see, the way the structure of the Eightfold Path starts with what is formless and then moves into form with right view, becomes right thought, or image, let's say, mental depiction, mental formation, ideas, images, that then find their way into speech and into acts and into work. Now, you could equally as well see that as a description of the artistic process, where you start with a certain intuitive vision of, or sense of something, and then you translate that through images, through ideas, through words or through acts in such a way that what was previously without form achieves form. Now, in some of the Mahayana ideas, the idea of the three bodies of the Buddha, maybe some of you are familiar with this idea, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and the Manakaya. That, I think, likewise, is describing awakening as a process rather than a state, and one that, in a way, moves from formlessness into form. So if we think of creativity as literally creating something, in other words, bringing something that previously did not exist into existence, in other words, giving something form, then we are engaged in a creative act. Now that could be simply being creative in our communications, in our speech, in our work, but of course it could also be being creative in our imagination, in our poetry, in our sculpture, in our dance workshops, whatever it might be. And again, I feel this is an element that has tended to be sidelined or, in a sense, slightly downgraded as a lay activity. In most Indo-Tibetan Buddhist cultures, the artist is somehow there at the service of the monks to create nice images and icons and tankas for the temple. It's not conceived of as a work or an activity that has an intrinsic, can be intrinsic to the Eightfold Path itself, except perhaps as right livelihood. But what we do find in Zen, in Korea, China, Japan, is that the creative activity, whether it be brush painting or tea ceremony or raked gravel gardens, is considered to be an integral part of the practice itself. And that to me is very important. And I think that's one of the great things about Zen, which I like very much, is it has even this room, you see, there's a lovely kind of aesthetic. There's an attempt, at least, to reflect a quality of mind in the actual organization of the space. Whereas I find, like, in the Thai temple last night, it's very devotional, it's very heartfelt, but it's also pretty over-the-top kitsch.
It's very Thai.
It's very Thai. But that's the level of... And in Tibet, Thai temples are like that, too.
Oh, they're worse.
Yes.
I know you sort of said after a stream entry it's all the same, there's more of the same. I was wondering if you could it's kind of revolutionary what you said about stream entry today. Not your revolution, but... likewise, so there's the whole orthodoxy of once returning and...
Once return and non-return are arhat. But again, all of that is only meaningful within the context of multiple lifetimes. I mean, once return, you get born once. Let's say the stream entrant only gets reborn 7 times max. You see? In other words, the whole idea is then incorporated into the multi-life worldview of ancient India.
It's
totally
true.
Well, you could, because if you look at the different qualities that are achieved at each level, they're spoken of in psychological terms. So in other words, but I don't find them entirely convincing, frankly. I can't even remember what they are, but at certain, you lose the three first, basically, there are 10 fetters in classical Theravada Buddhism. You do find them in the canon. They are canonical. You have 10 fetters, the first 3 go at stream entry, and then the other 7 go step by step until you become an arhat and you don't have no fetters left. And then you don't get born no more. So I think the way to approach that would be to look up the 10 fetters and see how the Buddha, or at least the canon, describes how they fall away. And curiously, for example, one of the last fetters to go is pride. So even though you've overcome individuality view, you're still stuck with pride. And I'm not sure that makes an awful lot of sense. And frankly, I'm not terribly interested in once return or non-return or arhat. I'm interested in stream entry. My hero is Ananda. He's the person I find... the most sympathetic, and especially when you get someone like Kasapa, you know, if anyone could say that they were enlightened, it would be me. I'm not drawn to that kind of personality. That's slightly arrogant, I think.
Not just the lion's roar.
The lion's roar?
Yeah, the lion's roar of enlightenment.
There is the lion's roar. Which I think is phrased in different ways, isn't it? If I remember rightly, I can't. It's basically, it's a sort of, It's not an arrogant assertion.
Yeah, it wouldn't involve putting down someone.
It wouldn't involve putting down. No, it wouldn't involve that. But it does. It is. I think it's again a positive thing in that you are making an affirmation of what it is that you have accomplished or achieved or understood, and that's a good thing. There's no need, therefore, to be sort of chronically humble, which is often considered to be a virtue. And the Buddhists are often, I've often noticed this, the Buddhists are saying, they're always talking about these elevated spiritual attainments, and yet they're terribly coy when it comes to their own. It's as though it's bad form. In fact, it's one against one of the monastic rules, particularly about you're not supposed to tell lay people anything about your experience.
I've experienced that. It's very offensive. A good friend would not talk about his experience.
Yeah, I don't quite see the point of that. I can see the point in that it prevents monks from somehow aggrandizing themselves for their own benefit. But I think it also, especially in our culture, looks a little bit suspect, a little bit precious, a little bit elitist.
Well, also, if it's a process, my process may not be yours.
Well, that's true. So again, it also seems to encourage this idea that you have a spiritual attainment, rather than recognize that you're involved in a process of living in this world and doing the best you can. And I'm pretty suspicious of these gradations and levels of accomplishment. They don't ring true somehow. I like, for example, in Zen, again, in Huineng, the sixth patriarch, has a wonderful expression. He says, when an ordinary person becomes awakened, we call them a Buddha. When a Buddha becomes deluded, we call them an ordinary person.
That's great. Yeah.
Which is nice, because it recognizes that it's not a strict linear thing at all. And again, that's one of the things I think is a great contribution from East Asian Buddhism, is a much more, is a much less linear sense of this process, a recognition that moments of great insight can occur out of the blue to anyone. This is what Zen is particularly keen on. And at the same time, moments of great delusion can occur out of the blue to anyone. There's not a kind of graduated ascent in which perfection is somehow guaranteed at the end of the road. That doesn't... I've been around lots of so-called accomplished Buddhist teachers and got to know them quite well and worked with them and translated for them. That's not been anything remotely like my actual experience of them as people. I don't think human beings do evolve in this kind of highly stratified way. It's machines do, but not people. Yes, and then we... yes, you haven't said anything. Shannon.
Does the Buddha say, or does your grouping, do you have anything about the Eightfold Path, particularly as it relates to that work? Because that's truly what a layperson, for the most part...
To work, I mean, work. Livelihood.
And in particular... thinking about this as being a kind of a process where it's almost like light and dark, you're in light and then you're in darkness and then you return to light, hopefully, as you're on the path. One of the things that I think we're struggling with very much, both in this economy and in this country, are these notions of success and failure in our work.
Yeah.
And I think it's what makes dying even more difficult to do if we are living with a sense of failure. And I think I'm beginning to reframe what my work is about, and it's not about succeeding or failing. And I wonder if you might have some thoughts.
Well, first of all, regarding the canon, the text you should probably look at is called the Sigalavada Sutta. It's in the Digha Nikaya. And it's one of the few texts where the Buddha explicitly addresses lay people. Some of it you might think of as a little bit commonsensical and not terribly illuminating. But he does talk about work. He talks even about things of, percentage of profit that should be reinvested and stuff like that, which is quite interesting. But it shows that at least there was a concern for these things. But in terms of what you're speaking of, which is almost a much more psychological relationship to work, I'm not aware of anything explicit in the canon that refers to that. As for my own take on it, again, all I can speak of my own work, I've been very privileged in that I'm able to, my work is also what I want to do anyway, which is study, write, teach. I don't always want to teach, but I tend to end up doing it. But basically, I'm fortunate in having a livelihood in which I can pursue the things that I would pursue anyway. But I have thought often in terms of what would thereby qualify as success and failure. And I've noticed that, particularly when I first started having books published, I could feel a great sense of success. That has long gone. I don't get that rush anymore when a book comes out. In fact, almost a certain sense of deflation. Oh, here it is. This is 10 years' worth. $8.99. but what I found with my work is that what I see my work more as I really do see it as a practice, and in that sense I see it as a vehicle whereby I seek to, in a sense, embody the values that I most aspire to. So can my work be can it be a form of generosity? Can it have a moral dimension to it? Am I being just and fair in what I write about? Am I being honest? So in other words, I see the work as a means of practicing and embodying the things I value. And that to me is a better benchmark for success, failure, than, let's say, some sort of external recognition or reward. But nonetheless, you know, I can't live on air and water yet, and so my work does need to generate income. Fortunately, we don't have many expenses. We don't have children. We own our house. We live simply, so we don't actually need a great deal to live on. The thing that perhaps is looming in the future is how we'll survive when we're in our 70s or 80s, because we have no provision at all, apart from some savings in the bank. And but what has, I think, been shown many times to be true with this work is that if you trust in the Dharma, as they say, somehow you'll be provided for. And I've found that to be true again and again and again. I've had periods of great poverty, great hardship, especially when I was a monk, when I was training, when I was first a lay person, when we had no qualifications, no job abilities, nothing. And yet, just by being true to what matters most for you, I think will in the end be its own reward, both spiritually and, in a sense, weirdly, materially. Should we conclude? That seems a good point to end on, since we're all going back to our... We have a few minutes left. I'd like to just sit quietly if we may.